Welcome back to the MJA podcast. My name is Kate Swanell. Have you ever been to your GP and been asked to fill in a form? One of the first questions asked is about your gender. Options always include male or female, and sometimes a third option, other. The problem with other is its non-specificity. As a piece of data, it's practically useless. New research published in the MJA attempts to fill some gaps in the data about transgender and gender-diverse Australians and raises the question, when does other mean invisible? Senior authors Denton Callender and Teddy Cook are my guests today. Denton is a senior research fellow at the Kirby Institute, and Teddy's the manager of trans and gender-diverse health equity at ACON.
Up until this point, there has been really no national surveillance-based epidemiology of trans people's HIV and sexual health.
But in your paper, you mentioned that there isn't even accurate gender information taken on a regular basis. How is that even remotely possible?
Great question. I kind of wish in some ways that it was as simple as being male, female or other. It's not.
No.
People are often counted in sexual health systems as being either male or female or transgender. This sort of catch-all third category, which really, and this is, you know, one of the things that I think really brought Denton into this kind of amazing space with me as an epidemiologist. Epidemiologists love good data. And the surveillance systems and data collection sort of methodologies that we have really create bad data. So,
was it terrible, Denton? Were you amazed?
It was actually, and I'm not sure if Teddy remembers this, but that's actually where we met. He gave a short presentation to a group I was at, and he was talking about this issue with gender. And honestly, it never occurred to me before. And at the time, I was coordinating the system from which this paper arose, a national sentinel surveillance system. And I went and looked, and of course he was right. Although there were a number of services that were properly identifying their patients as transgender and also as men or women, there were an equal number that were failing to do so, in part because the systems didn't even allow it. This paper focuses on sexual health clinics, really because they're the only clinics in Australia that are doing anything even remotely in this area. The largest general practice systems that are used, medical director and best practice, they don't allow it at all. There's really no option for anything other than male or female and occasionally other. And, you know, we've tried to engage with them a number of times and they're not interested in coming to the table. So partly we hope this paper will shift that conversation a little bit as well.
And why is it important that we get a little bit more specific than other in terms of patient's health?
I mean, I was just going to say that the proof of that or the answer to that question is it found at least partly in our results.
Yes.
So if you look at the differing rates of HIV and STIs between trans men and trans women, at least the ones who are attending these sexual health clinics, there are some marked differences. And if you're trying to deliver care, if you're trying to understand how to help people prevent and manage HIV and other STIs, you need to understand what the risks are. And this highlights that collapsing into a third single category is not only methodologically indefensible, but it undermines our public health efforts.
Part of the reason why it's so important to make sure that we capture trans people, trans and gender diverse people accurately and meaningfully is that really the trans experience has often been misunderstood as being a gender identity in and of itself. And that's why we see this sort of male or female or transgender sort of data collection options when really most trans people are just male or female. And one of the really big gaps that we found in this process is that non-binary people are completely erased. In one hand, we have this idea that all trans people are this sort of third category. And then when we have actual people that don't identify as male or female, they're completely invisible. This analysis showed a third of the sample were men, a third were women, and then another third really couldn't be further classified in terms of their gender and then couldn't be analysed. And then when you look at those people and you look at the characteristics of those people that couldn't further be classified, there's some really rich and important data there that we just don't have access to. most of those people are probably, I suspect, trans women, but we just don't know.
It is frustrating for sure to see their infection rates and their risk and be like, who are these people?
Yeah.
I'm personally am very keen to know, but what makes that'll have to wait, I suppose, for a few years.
What makes you think that most of them might be trans women, Teddy?
When you look at the sort of characteristics of the sample of people whose gender wasn't further recorded, there are some similarities to the women in the sample, trans women in the sample. My feeling is that, and this has been shown through this data as well, is that trans women who have been really strongly erased from the HIV response in Australia are shouldering is just not being appropriately accounted for. And we sort of see in these this sort of hidden, you know, collection of people that, you know, they are shouldering a burden. It's possible that they could be men, that there could be men in men who trans gangs and non-binary people, but we just don't know.
Denton, tell us a bit about the design and why you went that way.
Part of the reason that we conducted this study is that we realized, you know, aside from the need, is we realized that we actually did have a relatively large source of data on trans people in Australia. So this came about through a network of clinics from which we extract data. This program's been running for about 10 years. It's always refreshing and updating. And through working with the services and using specialized software, these data are automatically de-identified, extracted, and transmitted to our central server. So we have this really cool, powerful data set on bloodborne viruses and STIs. And as I said, in some clinics, we were able to identify transgender patients. That was really the first step, was to identify this group, get some sense of who they were. And then we conducted a series of analyses, both to estimate something like the prevalence of these infections among trans people. And we used first test positivity, which has been shown in some previous sexual health research to be a useful proxy for prevalence because it reduces the impact of repeat testing. So we did that overall, and then we also looked at that over time to see if things were changing, see if there were any trends. And then we created comparative groups of cisgender gay and bisexual men and cisgender heterosexual people, just as a way to put things in context. Anyone who's an epidemiologist knows it's often tricky to compare different groups of people, and it should be done with caution. But because we know so little about this in Australia, we needed some kind of way to put a frame around it or to help our audience and ourselves understand it a bit better. So we did that. And then the last thing we did was conduct a series of regression analyses to try to understand some of the independent factors that were associated with an increased likelihood of infection, including to assess if there were differences between those different gender-based categories I just described.
Teddy, what were the big results? What were the ones that maybe surprised you?
The results that really stood out for me was certainly that trans women shouldering a prevalence of chlamydia and gonorrhea, and in particular that gonorrhea has increased. And that's not surprising, but it's really important and good that we can reflect that. It was really good to see in terms of showing this population really for the first time. Trans men have, you know, when I say that trans women have been erased, trans men have been absolutely invisible. And what has been previously thought of a population as really as being of no risk at all in terms of STIs and HIV, a population of people who are often incorrectly seen as only having sex with cis women, for instance, what we see in these data is a much more significant prevalence of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and even trans men living with HIV has been previously thought of, given that previously it was considered that trans men had zero prevalence, really. And so some of the limitations of these data are, though, that we don't know some of the risk factors that come into play for this population because they just haven't been captured at the point of clinic visits. So in terms of condom use, we don't know out of these population, even though the research extended until the end of 2017, we don't know how many were on PrEP or not. But that we see, you know, trans men and trans women do have a prevalence of STIs, are living with HIV, even though that probably sounds like a very minor kind of thing to be really excited about or an odd thing to be excited about. To be able to see this reflected in these data is a huge outcome, I think.
I'm chatting today with Denton Callender and Teddy Cook about trans and gender diverse sexual health. Their co-authored research is available at mja.com.au, where, like all our research, it is open access. This podcast and all our podcasts are available for free via iTunes, Podomatic, and on our website at mja.com.au/podcasts. Back to our chat. Just to be clear about the results, you found that transgender women are more likely to have STIs than cisgender heterosexual patients. What does that tell us? I mean, does it tell us anything useful in terms of their healthcare?
For me, it tells us that trans women in particular there needs to be a concerted, focused effort to make sure that trans women who are vulnerable to STIs and HIV are appropriately reflected in the policy frameworks that guide the national conversation about sexual health in this country. At the moment, it's only been a very recent addition that trans and gender diverse people have been added to the federal HIV strategy, and we aren't included in any other strategy other than Victoria at a state and territory level as a priority population. We're sort of seen to be across all of the other priority populations, you know, because we are across every other priority population in terms of trans men that have sex with other men, trans people who do sex work, trans people that inject drugs, etc., trans people who are Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander. But it's unusual to see any of these particular priority population focuses having a specific additional focus on the trans people that sit across those populations. So we sort of exist in the fringes of different priority populations, but aren't really kind of focused on.
Which is really too bad, Teddy, as you say, because as we, these data are and Teddy and I have been working on a number of projects in this space over the past couple of years, and these findings are among many that suggest that trans and gender diverse people do have unique needs when it comes to these infections. So when we fail to include them in our strategy, fail to reflect their unique needs, which is obviously problematic.
One of the really important contextual experiences that underpin these data is that trans and gender diverse people report extremely high levels of marginalization in healthcare settings. Yeah. You know, we see trans people who report barriers to accessing testing services just generally, and very low rates of uptake of PrEP. In a report that will be launched next week at the ASHAM conference, the report of the findings from Australia's first trans and gender diverse sexual health survey, which Denton and I and a large group of trans researchers led, we found that trans people have got, out of our sample, which is the biggest sample ever captured of trans people in Australia, really pretty low rates of testing, high rates of convalescence, low rates of PrEP uptake. And we also found that people who experienced discrimination, stigma, marginalisation and sexual health settings were less likely to test. Have these sort of social determinants that influence sexual health, and in an environment where this population isn't being seen as important. So all of this literature is sort of leading to a point that says trans people need to be included.
Denton, what would you like to see happen next?
Well, I mean, the good thing about this study and the other study that Teddy just mentioned, our large survey, is there's been pretty well received, you know, the findings as we share them, policymakers, sexual health clinic directors, sexual health physicians, the kinds of people who have the power to make changes are certainly paying attention to these issues. At least that's been my perspective.
Right.
And it's exciting to see these data so quickly become a vehicle for change, at least in some domains. But that being said, there's a lot more detail that we need to get, including by engaging more directly with communities of trans and gender diverse people to understand the kinds of things that they need when it comes to sexual health care. Because it's one thing to say and be able to use, for example, the findings of this paper to advocate for, let's say, funding or the very least attention to HIV and other STIs among trans people. But it's another thing to know what is appropriate or what is likely to be effective to engage these diverse groups in care. And I think there's definitely an appetite for that. But now that we've kind of said, okay, this is something we need to pay attention to, it has an impact on both individual and public health, the next step in my mind is really to get into the details and try to understand how we enhance our services, how we make them gender inclusive, and meeting trans and gender diverse people where they are.
As opposed to making them go into some huge practice where the receptionist might well be a bit testy.
Yeah, or the paperwork that they're forced to complete doesn't even come close to allowing them to identify their gender appropriately.
Exactly,
and that puts a bad taste in their mouth and has a flow-on effect. As Teddy said, you know, we presented an analysis at a conference earlier this year that shows a quite direct link between those things. So if you don't feel respected in healthcare, and this is, of course, true across the spectrum of health, you're less likely to engage in healthcare. That's troubling, but it's a really important thing, at least for me, to try to remember as I think about the kind of work that needs to come next.
Teddy, if you could wave a magic wand, what would you wave it over first up?
There are two things that I would do. One, I would update every single data collection, nook and cranny, in every place in this country to ask people two questions. One, what was presumed to you at birth and how do you identify now? Not asking people if they're trans, asking people what they're assigned at birth and what their gender identity is now. And then and that just shows every variety of trans person and every variety of cisgender person as well. And then the second thing that I would do would be to, if I could wave my magic wand, would be to embed gender-affirming healthcare into not only primary care but also sexual health clinics across the country. What we know is that when people are able to access gender-affirming hormonal care, particularly, their sexual health outcomes, their mental health outcomes improve.
Denton, what about you? Where would you wave your epidemiological wand?
Well, Teddy, I think maybe you are a closet epidemiologist, if that's your first wish, is to improve data collection. And I'm totally there with you 100%. And the troubling thing about that particular issue, which, as I said, I really want to be something that this paper helps us focus our attention on, is that it's ubiquitous around the world. I live here in the United States now, and you know, we're having the same kind of really tedious, non-evidence-based arguments about how we ask gender through something like the census. My magic wand is pretty simple, actually, and it's achievable. It's to use best evidence to guide our data collection policies, and that's exactly what Teddy's just described. And if we could do that, it would be step one on getting a proper handle on the epidemiology of these infections. And as I said, I think this paper takes us in that direction, but really there's so much further to go.
You know, so I work at ACON, I'm manager of trans and gender diverse health equity. We were doing a bit of an office clear out very recently. On my desk landed an original report by Roberta Perkins that was published in 1994 called Transgender Lifestyle, HIV and AIDS. And it was a mainly sort of qualitative analysis of about 150 trans people across the whole country. I looked at the instrument that was used in that survey, and question 2 and 3 is, what gender were you given at birth? And the other question was, what gender are you now? And this was 20
awesome.
Years ago.
Yeah, 25.
And 20. Oh, no.
Yeah, sorry.
25
sorry.
Years ago. I still think 1994 was the other day.
Yeah, me too.
This was recommended 25 years ago, and we're still fighting for it.
It's sort of disheartening, but it's also kind of like, I don't know if you're aware of this, but from my reading, this will be the first empirical study on transgender health ever published by the NJA. You know, they have the odd commentary on guidelines and stuff.
Yes.
This is kind of an exciting time for this area of health. Like, there's political attention. People have growing social awareness. So, you know, I share Teddy's frustration that I can't believe we're still, you know, but we're building on Roberta Perkins' excellent work, and hopefully now is the time when people finally take note.
Thank
Great.
You.
Thanks.
Great conversation. Good.
Thanks very much.
Terrific research. Thank you. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.